Hello and welcome to this Royal Children's Hospital podcast series, Life, Love and Loss, Caring for a Child Who is Dying, produced by the Victorian Paediatric Palliative Care Program and nationally funded by Quality of Care Collaborative Australia. My name is Lena Kaneva and I'm a journalist and the facilitator of this five-part series. This series will focus on the experience of parents whose children have died or are likely to have a short life. The parents we're about to hear from have been supported by palliative care teams to face multiple challenges in caring for their own children. They bravely share their experiences to inform and prepare other families who may need to face similar challenges. In this episode, Just Call Me Dad, we talk to two fathers and explore their experiences of caring for their child, their family, and themselves. As we heard in a previous podcast in this series, Simon is a father who experienced a cancer diagnosis for both his son Marmaduke and his wife Milsom. His son died at the age of 4, just 5 weeks after Simon's wife, who had breast cancer. Welcome back, Simon.
Thank you.
Guy and his wife Juliet's son Gus was diagnosed with late infantile Batten disease when he was 4 years old. He passed away just a year later. Thanks for coming on, Guy. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start again with you, Simon. Tell us about your family and the journey and caring for two loved ones at the same time.
Well, I suppose if I set the scene when Marmaduke was first diagnosed, he was appeared to be an incredibly healthy toddler and just got one of those, you know, little bugs and viruses. He was off colour for a few days. And we thought we'd maybe miss something like an ear infection or something. So we took him to the GP and then suddenly it all began to sort of cascade from there. And we found ourselves in the Royal Children's probably within about 2 or 3 days and off it went. And I suppose when I think back, Milsom, my wife, was pregnant at the time. So she was wandering around the corridors with an enormous tummy. We had a young son who was in and out of childcare. And my daughter was in the middle of high school, quite a difficult sort of early teenage time for anyone. And I suppose the story then is like a lot of families, you're suddenly thrown straight into oncology journey. Because of chemo, I became the full-time carer because it was kind of tricky for a pregnant woman to come near a lot of those harsh chemicals. That was quite challenging for my wife. Milsom really wanted to be there for Marmaduke, but at the same time, juggling the other children at home was also important. So we tried to juggle it where we could, but essentially I became full-time carer from then on. To fast forward, we had a really intense first year, but at the end of that, my son was actually NED, no existing disease. So he was cleared, did some amazing work at the Royal Children's. But just because of what he had, there was a risk of relapse. But we were incredibly confident. Naively confident, as it were. And we thought, well, let's just get his strength back and we'll go and take a break. And so 3 months later, we took a break, went up to Byron Bay and had all the family back together. And that's when my Milsom found a lump in her breast and we just stared at her, oh, God, right. But because we'd spent, you know, a whole year immersed, I guess, in oncology, it was almost like, well, let's just get back on the horse. So I think my youngest would have been, 5 or 6 months at that stage. So literally we came back to Melbourne, literally weaned him overnight. And then she went, bang, mastectomy, and then straight into standard. And I say it is standard sort of breast cancer scenario. Then unfortunately, literally, I think it was about 4 days before her final radio treatment. So the end of her treatment, Marmaduke relapsed. Because the cancer had come back, but it had almost been hidden in a leg bone, so it wasn't really appearing. And then he actually fractured his leg, and that's how we found it. So bang, straight back into hospital. We were, strangely, we had such good relationships with everybody at the Royal Children's. We weren't happy to be here, but there was reassurance coming back to familiar faces. But we thought, God, everyone's being really flat. But that's because the professionals knew how tough a relapse was, and we were, as I say, naive. We didn't realise just how bad it was going to be. And so that was the beginning of the arc where he was, we put him on chemo. Unfortunately, with some cancers, there isn't a lot to choose from once you've relapsed, because you can't go anywhere near what you used the first time around, naturally, because you relapsed. And then we realised, well, actually, that, you know, the first shelf is ruled out. So then you look at the second shelf, and that's when you realise it's pretty bare. So we tried one cocktail, and we tried that for, I think we're going to try 3-4 cycles. And strangely, Milsom had finished her treatment. It was quite a shock to her. She was looking forward to just relief, but then her son was back in hospital. And then 3 months after she finished her treatment, she relapsed, and it had jumped from her breast to her liver, so she was terminal. Although we didn't know how long that meant. And not long thereafter, we also began to realise the chemo wasn't going to be working for Marmaduke. So it was having an impact, but it wasn't turning the tide. And so we very quickly found we then had two terminal journeys.
And a very long journey it must have seemed. And we will come back and ask you some more questions about how it all progressed. Guy, can I come to you and ask you to tell us about your family and the journey with Gus?
Sure. So Gus was, obviously we thought he was a happy, very happy, healthy baby. And physically he was pretty robust and I think when he was about, just before he was two, we started to realise there was maybe some delays going on. He was actually diagnosed with autism, and we went down that path for a while with different types of therapy. I think it's fair to say, from my opinion, he did have that. He was, unfortunately, had the two things to struggle with. So with that, his speech was delayed, and he sort of wasn't probably a normal functioning child from that age. And then not too long after that, he had his first seizure, and that was a bit of a massive shock to us. He actually, one of the things with Batten's disease is the seizures. So we actually went to a specialist, and unfortunately they didn't pick up on the Batten's, and the seizures increased. And I think it was about a year that he was medicated and stuff for the seizures, but then he started to regress. So we had some progression with the autism, but then he started to lose some functionality. And we decided to get a second opinion, and we came to the Children's Hospital, and we saw, when he came into the hospital, he was actually walking. We saw a specialist here. He said he thinks there's something particularly wrong here. He wanted to do some tests, do a lumbar puncture test of his spinal fluid. So that happened, and then we got called back in a week, I think it was about a week later. And he was progressing quite badly at that stage. And but when he came back in, he actually wasn't even able to walk. So it was quite rapid. He was walking with a massive gait at that when he first came in. But so when we came back in to see the doctor, we walked in the room and there was another lady in with the doctor. And I was like, that's odd. And she introduced herself as a social worker, which was not a good sign. And I think at that time, thinking back on it, I always pictured as myself sort of as a looking down on that room and remembering it as a sort of a bad scene of a movie where he was telling us that he had found something and that it was a disease called Batten's, and it was, you know, it was terminal. And obviously when you hear those words, it's pretty horrific. But I think it was all a bit of a blur. As we walked out of the hot, we seemed to always look back and think how weird it was that I think we went and spoke to someone else, but then we left and we were in the car going back home with Gus in the back seat in his chair, just thinking, what's just happened to us? So he was diagnosed with late infantile Batten disease. We told he had really months, not years. I don't think really it sinks in that at that point how little time you have. He wasn't verbal. He was never really able to ever say a full sentence, even though he was four at the time. There was words and there was, you know, there was a lot of personality, but there wasn't, you know. So the journey for us was frequent trips to the hospital to change meds. The epilepsy got worse. He lost mobility. He lost the ability to eat. He obviously had to go on a gastric tube and then or nasal, then gastric. Then he really did obviously go downhill quite quickly and, you know, he lost all functionality to be able to walk, sit up, eat. And so his sister, Lottie, she would have been six at the time. That's quite a lot to go through as a kid at that age, not knowing what's going on. And also there's a lot of focus on obviously on Gus. So it was about a year after he was diagnosed just over that he passed away. And for us, we decided, we left the hospital for the final time and decided to go to Very Special Kids for that process. I think it was really important for us to, for those last days, for my wife to be a mum and not a caregiver. So that's why we chose that. And I just felt that being at home, she would be a more of a caregiver than just a mum. So we went to Very Special Kids and, yeah, Gus passed away there. He actually went to school for the first time, I think, about a week before that. So he got his first day of school, which was great. But, that's kind of the journey for Gus. Obviously, there was a lot more to it than that.
And we will get to that.
Sure.
And thanks for sharing that with us. Families function in many varied and individual ways, with parents taking on various roles and responsibilities across the parenting spectrum. Parents are key caregivers and decision makers in pediatric palliative care and are central to the care team. Parents face many challenges when caring for their child with a life-limiting condition. Fathers play a key role in the lives of their children and need to be supported in their individual coping styles. And that's what we're talking about today, Simon and Guy. What's unique about being a dad in this situation, do you think?
I think from my perspective, one thing I found really, really challenging was I was still going to work. I had a business, but I felt guilty for going to work. My wife was obviously caring for Gus pretty much full time. She was full time. But I felt guilty going to work. And then when I stayed home, I felt guilty for staying at home and not being at work. I think the pressure was, I felt the pressure pretty heavily in that respect. You know, in hindsight, I wish I'd spent more time at home. But I don't know, it's just, I think when you're in that moment, it's hard to get that clarity. And I think as a supporting role too, to my wife, whoever partner you have, I think, you know, I found maybe for stuff for me it was buried a bit deeper. I don't think my grief or my pain was as near to the surface as Juliet. Obviously, as a male, I think it's fair to say we want to fix things. We want to try and make this okay, and we couldn't, and I couldn't. I couldn't make it better. And so it took me a while to get my head around the fact that it's not my job anymore. And I think I struggled with that really, really hard at the start that this is not something that can be repaired or I can have all the answers to, because I had no answers to it.
Simon, you were the principal caregiver in this setting. So how did it make being dad as well change the way you operated? How did it affect you?
Look, I think in some ways, listening to Guy, some of those decisions were almost taken away. We couldn't make them. It was just, you know, bang, I became the full-time carer. There was no other option. I do remember, though, just in those first couple of weeks, you know, sitting at the bedside when Marmaduke was asleep with the laptop open, working on emails, you know, trying to contribute to meetings. And that was I think that's not an uncommon thing. It's that, it's not just identity, it's about guilt, it's about wanting to, and it's probably, I'm sure there's a component early on where you're, even if it's not denial, you're trying to grasp or hang on to the idea of normality. And very quickly, once you were actually, because I was in the hospital, I was observing exactly what my son was going through. I was often up most of the night, sort of, you know, helping him, comforting him. You begin to realize, hang on, you've got to get the priorities right. And once we'd actually settled through a few months of chemo, I mean, I backed off work, taken stress leave, and they'd been as generous as they could be. But I do remember going in about 3 or 4 months later, going, okay, right, we're kind of into the cycles. I think I can probably do, you know, maybe three weeks a month. Maybe I can't guarantee which days. I need a bit of flexibility. And they weren't having any of that. There was no, it wasn't going to work. And of course, it's not funny, but I mean, when I look back, the reality was, what actually happened is I spent 3 out of every 4 weeks in hospital with him for the next year. I just had no idea, because although people can talk about, oh, here's the protocol and it might be a few days of chemo. It doesn't work like that, because these little bodies react in different ways. They get fevers, they get infections. So you go in for 3 days, you're actually suddenly in for 7 or 8. And so if you're out, it might be for 2 or 3 days. And that was the difficulty with when you've got other siblings, because you get the whole family together, everyone's back together, literally within an hour, Marmaduke's temperature might have spiked and I'm throwing him in the car, dropping off a daughter on the way to go straight into emergency. So you cannot, as a parent, you realise, well, you actually can't plan a week ahead. You can barely plan a day ahead. And that's very hard for all the siblings, because they become, it's an odd word, they almost become orphans of the oncology journey, because you want to be dad, you want to be mom, you want to be 100% focused, and you try to be, and so you do your best. But as soon as there's a whimper or a temperature change in that corner room, bang, everything stops. And so that's really, really hard for other kids, particularly when they're in that very egotistical stages. So it's very challenging.
I think for me also, it's the role of a husband to my wife. I mean, obviously different journey than yours, but I, you know, that her being the primary caregiver, I don't know, I sometimes probably felt like a bit out of that kind of space. I mean, obviously there was times that I would be the care to give Juliet a break and stuff, but yeah, it was definitely probably felt a little bit on the outer in that sense. And some of it was probably my own doing, not knowing what to do and not knowing how to knowing I probably couldn't do it as well as she could do it. Yeah.
You were both in pediatric palliative care programs at this stage. Did you want to know things that your wife didn't want to know? Did you think you should have been told things, or how were you approached as part of that process?
I think I probably was a little bit in denial about the journey. Certainly near the end, when things were getting close, I think I thought we had more time than we did, and I think Juliet knew that it was bad. I don't think she didn't tell me that, but whether she assumed I knew or not. I think early on, I think pretty clear, I think maybe it's a male thing, I don't know, but I wanted to know how long we had. I wanted to know what the steps were. I wanted to know when's this going to happen, when's that going to happen. I wanted it all laid out. And they weren't able to do that for us because there's a pattern to it with this disease, but they're all different. So I suppose I probably wanted that information. I thought the care was amazing, but I'd never been in anything like this before. It was, you know, it was a whirlwind of frequent visits, like you were saying, Simon. It's like you come in because he's not well, and all of a sudden they're admitting him because they think he needs some time here, and they want to do stuff. And it's a classic example. Is you tell your daughter you're taking Gus to get checked today, and then she go to get picked up from school, and you weren't there because someone else was picking them up because they've actually had to admit him. And I think from an information point of view, they were pretty good. I think as parents, you're on the internet trying to find out more information. You're trying to find out other stories, trying to find out what does it really look like? What are they not telling us? I think they have to be careful what they say because they don't want to give best case and then it becomes worst case or worst case. And then, you know, so it is pretty beige, I think.
Searching for the cure?
Definitely knew there was no cure because there was some early treatments out there that were happening, but it just felt like a million miles away. I felt like it was just the time we were in, we were just going to miss that. And I didn't want to spend energy on that when we needed to spend energy on being with him. I know now that there's some treatment stuff that's happening around the world for the disease that Gus had, which is heartbreaking. But at the time, I think it was we don't have time to do this. It would have just been just a complete misery for him and maybe just prolong things a little bit because there was some early stuff. But I think the more of a journey for how do we make this the best, you know, what can we do to make his time better was probably what we were seeking and, you know, trying to make him as comfortable as possible.
Yeah. Simon, you were in the palliative care process. Mm-hmm. You would have been fairly unusual being the father and the caregiver given the situation your wife was in. What did you think you wanted to know about that perhaps, you know, you had to negotiate with the PALCARE team?
I think early on, we were both incredibly thirsty for knowledge, and that idea of the web search and Dr. Google, it's very much a two-edged sword, and you can lose yourself in exhaustion and panic really easily in those first few weeks. That's quite a common occurrence. So the best advice we got was from a surgeon, the consultant, who both said, okay, right, we'll give you, because we were talking about everything we'd see, and they said, well, look, we'll give you, say, three websites around the world that we're confident share similar protocols to Australia. So then whatever you find, we're happy to answer. Because unfortunately, when you go online, there's a lot of subjective websites. There's a lot of people with, not an axe to grind, but, you know, with a particular focus. And it can be... it can give the wrong impression and it can be quite misguiding in some ways. I'd say it's more dangerous situation now. There is so much more information out there, and that also creates pressures in the community where people, you know, there might be relatives going, oh, well, aren't you trying this cure? And we're going to fundraise. And well, which actually puts pressure on a parent before they've actually made the decision. So I think you need to tread very carefully. I think from, you asked what did I want to ask. Early on, we asked everything. And we looked at alternative, complementary. But we had a great consultant who'd seen a lot. Basically, the sort of consultant that people went, oh my God, you've got him. Because he appeared to be this very grizzled curmudgeon. In fact, he was incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly compassionate, but incredibly well-read and thoughtful. So he considered everything. So there was no question that was off limits, but he would give us his considered opinion. And so that allowed us to construct some road signs and some ideas about what we wanted to do. If I fast forward to when we were thinking about palliative care, that was more challenging. And as Guy says, I certainly wanted to know, when's it going to happen? What's it going to look like? What's he going to go through? What are the signals? How long have we got? What are we going to do? What are the stages? Now, how a disease then impacts on a child's body is incredibly individual. It depends on the constitution, the success of the drug. So no one can really tell you. And so that was the hardest bit. They're almost pregnant pauses and silences. I almost didn't know... what's that horrible phrase of known unknowns? Yes. I didn't know the questions I needed to ask. Yes. I kind of knew I wanted more and I knew I wasn't getting it. I also now realise that information wasn't there to be given. Mm. And that can be quite challenging.
Did your wife have other questions?
Look, to be fair, Milsom, by this stage, she was terminal, and so... she found the whole concept of, we tag team. So I'd be up with my family researching all sorts of information and asking nurses, doctors, consultants. I'd be pulling all the information down and then I'd be sitting down and sorting it through with Milsom. With hindsight, there was a component of... for Milsom, there was kind of strength and selflessness where she didn't want to put herself in front of her son. So she didn't really want to make a lot of her own journey. At the same time, there was clearly a component of denial there for her as well. And so the terminal nature of her son and palliative care, that just brought her own journey into incredible focus. So it was challenging for her. So she didn't necessarily want to have casual conversations about, you know, what could be available. That was literally me. Yep, I'm going to do that. I'm going to download all the information, which is what PALCARE do as well. So they'll come and say, look, this is what we do. This is our team. These are all the amazing things we can do. And often they're telling you that very early on when you haven't really...
connected the dots.
You've connected the dots, but you haven't actually, I suppose you haven't seen the decline. And so I was basically downloading everything so that if we had to press the button, bang, it was all done. And in reality, it's not really about pressing the button. PALCARE are there all the way through. So in terms of pain management, consulting, they're there. They're just, I guess we had 5 months of PALCARE, but maybe the first two were almost behind the curtain. And then the last three were incredibly close. And so I think at the relationship with Milsom, we tag-teamed and we did... we tag-teamed in terms of information, but also in terms of how we managed the kids. And it was difficult. It's interesting listening to Guy, because in a way... I was feeling guilty about being the full-time carer because every day, all night, I'm there with Marmaduke, and I knew it was really painful for Milsom to come in and see that. And so we'd sort of try and, you know, I'd swap over at about 2:30 in the afternoon. I'd race off and do the school pickups, see the kids, throw some food together for them, bring them back into the hospital. Swap over with Mum, she'd take them home and I'd be back into my... And it was my pattern. I'd become such... that was almost more familiar living in the hospital with Marmaduke than it was being at home. And so that was really challenging. And we knew it wasn't perfect for the other kids. You're trying to be the best you can. You're trying to appear for them, but it's not... You ultimately have to make peace that you're trying to do the best you can with the little that you have and the knowledge that you've got. And that's kind of what we did.
And Guy, did your wife want to know different things to you? Was her focus on dealing with this about different things she needed to know, how it was going to end? Where, you know, did she ask different things?
I think so. I think she definitely, she spent a lot of time, oh no, I would say since a lot of time, I think she spent more time than me looking at the journey on whether it be online and I don't think we were always together when there was, we went to every appointment together, so pretty much. I think we probably were on the same information page from the palliative team. From a own discovery, she may have, I have a feeling that she was looking at other things that I wasn't. I think, as I said before, I probably was more in denial about it, in that it was really going to happen. But I think she was very aware of what was happening, and that, you know, it was, yeah. I think my other thing I was going to say is that with the whole professional thing is, like, if you feel you don't know the answer, then ask the question. Or if you feel you're not happy with what you're getting, you need to change. You know, when we thought we weren't getting the right diagnosis initially with Gus, and we changed, and it was actually a change of hospital, but it could have just been specialist. It's like, the thing we learned over the time is that having the right people was everything. We had one particular pediatrician at the hospital here that was amazing, that changed, as a game changer for us. And I think that you just got to try and find the best. And I think as parents you try to, but sometimes you worry that you might not be going through the system the right way, but you've got to push it a little bit. Because sometimes, there are the right people out there for you. So does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did your relationship change within the family structure, with kids, with other family members, parents, grandparents? Did you feel your role changed at all in the whole process?
As a father and as a husband, oh look, it's a stressful time. There's no two ways about it. You know, it's a time about, you know, like, how do I put this? I think, you know, the challenge, the biggest challenge was for me was with Juliet, was how she was dealing with the whole thing and how I was dealing with it. It was different as we grieved different, we dealt with it differently. And, you know, if I could do it again and have that time again with Juliet, I'd try and be more present. I'd be more of a listener than trying to solve things. When she's telling me about how she's feeling, not trying to give answers to it, but just be present. I'd probably do that better. That would be my advice. As a father, I think, you know, it's hard with Lottie. I think she probably felt that she was well out of the loop. A bit like what you were saying, Simon, but there's so much going on with Gus, and we knew we had so little time that there was a massive focus. Of course, we included her in everything, but, you know, that wasn't really, at 6 years old, wasn't really what she wanted to be doing. You know, she wanted to do her thing as well. I think there was a balance there, but I think that, you know, she would probably, you know, was I the best dad to her at that time? I don't know.
But did she ask you questions specifically?
I don't think so. I think at that stage, I think she was, I don't know, I don't think she really, I mean, she knew that what was going on completely. I think she was a little bit scared about what was going to happen. I don't think we had open conversations, but I don't think she really approached me directly on it. You know, my family are in New Zealand. That was hard. They came over a fair bit. Juliet's parents were local. They spent a lot more time. I think sometimes the parents were hard. It was hard for them to see what was going on with their children, what they were coping with. It was a big issue for them. Probably, you know, I'd be horrible to watch, I imagine, if it was my daughter going through it, feeling a little bit helpless. I think it was I was trying to keep everything as normal as I could as a dad, trying to keep the atmosphere in the house or the as normal as I could, and we tried to keep things as You know, we tried to do things as much as we could with Gus, not just for to, but also to get out of the house and take him places and have, not just to create memories, but also just to try and keep the family doing things together, and that was important.
And the worst part is planning for the end.
Yes.
What sort of conversations were you having about what you wanted it to be like?
I think for us, it kind of crept up pretty quick. As I said earlier, I think I probably was a little bit in denial of. I remember when we had our first meeting with palliative, they bought a bag of medicine and said, "Put this somewhere safe. You're going to need it one day." And I was like, "Whoa, that's pretty full on." We never needed it because we never went. It was never at home. We went to very special kids, but. I think I remember talking about it with Juliet after Gus passed, and I knew he was sick at the very at Christmas because he passed in February, and I was like, he started to change in the way he looked and his skin colour, and you know, he just started to look different. And in hindsight, Juliet knew what was going on. She knew it was close. I don't think we had that conversation, even though we had a lot of conversations. I don't know whether that's a pretty hard one. So it probably wasn't, well, I wasn't listening, which is possible. I don't think we had that conversation. The last time he went to hospital, he was getting, you know, liquid in his lungs and stuff, and we had to take him in, and that was the last time. And I didn't think that was going to be the last trip. I was like, oh, here we go again. We're off to the hospital again. And it was always, we always seemed to bounce back from that and be able to come home. And we never came home again. That was the hardest part. But yeah, I don't think we had that conversation.
Simon, were you able to have that kind of end of life discussion about Marmaduke with your wife in the situation you were in?
It was probably a more philosophy. I think the philosophy was, let's just live every day as well as we can. Let's make the most out of it for him. So initially, when you talk about these conversations about terminal full-time care, I mean, really what we're talking about is loving parents looking after a little boy or a little girl for other families. And when I look back to Marmaduke, every day he didn't wake up as a cancer patient. He woke up as a three-year-old wanting to have fun or a four-year-old wanting to be mischievous. And he'd be playing jokes with the nurses. He'd be looking for, of course, looking for comfort and reassurance, but he was also looking for fun and entertainment. So once we knew that the treatment wasn't going to work, in a way, because Milson was already terminal, it made our decision-making a little bit easier. We weren't tempted... it just wasn't possible to go searching for that elusive treatment overseas, the miracle cure in Germany or wherever it would be, because we couldn't actually... Our conversation with the consultant was, look, we need him to be comfortable, but we don't want anything experimental, because anything that was going to spike a fever, for example, meant that I was disappearing for a week into hospital with Marmaduke, which meant Milson... who was terminal, was then going to be juggling the remaining kids on her own. So it took that out of that came out of the equation. And so we just said, right, we just want him home. That was the overall philosophy, whatever it takes to get him home. And so we got him out of hospital, got him home. And at this stage, he was kind of, to all intents and purposes, he was active, he was laughing, he was hobbling around. And then we thought, what would we miss? What would we want to do with him? And we thought, well, what do we love? So we came into the hospital, spoke to the consultant, got some training from the nurses, because Marmaduke had, you know, drug lines going into his body, and, you know, you've got to be incredibly careful with infection. But we got trained up, and we then loaded up, and we took him bush camping. So we sort of went to one of our favourite spots, and about 7 hours out of Melbourne, and... Just went bush camping with him. And although he couldn't walk, he could hobble around, and he had a brace. So I got like an inflatable dinghy and just tugged him round the estuary. And then I found a little, you know, a little old plastic toboggan. So I put a long rope on that and he could kneel on it and I could drag him along the beach and in a few inches of water, and he went fishing, he could be on the beach, he could be trailing his hands in the estuary with his brothers and his sister. Had the absolute ball. Amazing. So we had about 3 weeks in the bush, and that's when he was quite active. Now, and then we continued to do that. So if we had a moment where we could get in the garden or go to the park, we'd do it. So you try and keep it as normal as you can. It was towards the end, and this can be quite challenging. It's not about being a father or a mother, just as a parent. You don't, as Guy says, you don't know. No one can say, oh, it's going to be 6 months. Sometimes they can. We didn't know how long Milsom had. We didn't know how long Marmaduke had. It just so happened that they both began to decline at the same time, which was kind of really bad timing. But and so we got him home as his needs became more challenging. And that might be that his mobility was decreasing. So then through PowerCare, we were able to get, you know, like a big comfy recliner on wheels so that we could still move him around the house. He can still sit in the lounge with his brothers and sister and watch videos. And then when he declined further, I guess the difference was Milsom we just crashed. The wheels fell off. And so we weren't really ready for that. She always thought, and that maybe that, look, looking back, you know, unless you're in someone else's shoes, you can't really walk that journey. She always thought she'd have months to put everything together, and it just didn't happen that way. And so we had them both at home, and then she crashed and suddenly had to go into hospital and didn't really come out. Like, they said, oh, suddenly you've got weeks, not months. Although, to be honest, until we'd walked in, I didn't even know it was months. So we thought it was... and so we stabilised her, got a family room, and then literally I was doing... It's hilarious when I look back. I was like getting Marmaduke out of his bed, getting him into the car, dropping one of the boys off at school, dropping the other one at childcare, then putting Marmaduke in his wheelchair and getting him into the hospital to see his mum. But that literally lasted about 9 days. So she died after about 9 days. And so it was less a case of what were our plans. Events just kind of rolled. And the idea was, well, whatever you do, we just got to keep the kids entertained and be really present for Marmaduke. And just, because he was still happy as Larry, even though physically, you know, he had a few issues going on. I guess what really brought it home was about 4 days after Milsom died, all the pain meds stopped working for Marmaduke. So he crashed. So then I'm literally I had him in my arms, because neither Milsom nor I had family in Australia. So we were, yeah. A bit of juggling went on, shall we say. And literally, I had him on my arms and I was going to the front door and I put my hand on the door, and literally my sister had just arrived from France and she had her arm on the others, just was entering. And I said, I've got to get him to hospital. And I had such trust that literally it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She rang me and said, oh, now, bedtimes, food for the kids. I went, oh my God. I had such trust. She'd never, you know, she'd literally arrived from France and I just left her with the house full of kids. And, you know. But anyway, so we got Marmaduke in hospital and they stabilised him. And then the next day they said, right, he's going. And I'm going, oh, I wanted him at home. But because I knew the staff so well, I thought, well, I'll make, you know, we'll make peace with that. He's around people who really care for him. And so I got my daughter to come in and say, literally, formally say goodbye. My boys had been in and out. And so I think they'd left by the time we realised he was going. And this is almost a comedy sketch, because that afternoon I'd actually had to have an appointment with a funeral director in the hospital to arrange Milsom's funeral. And you are literally sitting there with this very black humour going, well, my sister was like, we're going to do a 2-for-1 deal. Like, it was like, it was just...
How else can you cope here?
Well, exactly. And she said to me, well, you know, what are you going to do at the funeral? I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, if Marmaduke's sick. I said, well, oh, I'll be at his bedside. She said, yes, no, but if there's a funeral, who's your second choice? I said, there isn't one. It has to be me. And we were having these hypotheticals about what are you going to do? And, you know, we'd got relatives in the air almost coming to Australia. And I'm going, we can't. She said, no, it's for you. It's, you know, what are we going to do? So the compromise in the end was, well, then if he was crashing, I'd stay with him and we'd somehow maybe have a funeral and then do a public one, then maybe do a family event later. So we're trying to juggle all these hypotheticals. Even my son's in the next room. And then everyone said goodbye. And then that night, I sat down. And I didn't mention this, but I didn't actually get a vigil with my wife, because by the time I got all the kids organised and I got back to the hospital, gone within about an hour, I think. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to sit down and have a vigil with my son. And I did. And hospital gets very quiet. And I just spoke. He wasn't responding. He was just looking very peaceful. And I was talking to him. And I, like, you know, the classic, the light slowly dawns and the bird chorus comes out. And then he opened an eye. And he looked at me and he raised his little finger and he said, I want a baby chino and a special juice. And that, I mean, I tell that story because you said, well, what did we plan? Well, that was it, because then the nurse unit manager came in and said, oh my God, you know, we're so sorry. But it's pediatrics, you can't plan. They assumed he was dying that night, but these little bodies have ideas of their own.
Resilience.
And so she said to me, do you want to take him home? And I was like, oh my God. And I'd released that whole thought. And then when she said, do you want to take him? I said, yes. And so by about 2 o'clock that afternoon, Palcare had arranged a massive electric operated bed, an air mattress. It was all in his room. Everything was ready for him. So he could just go home in an ambulance, be put in his room. And this is the kid who we thought literally was dying the night before. He was back in his room with his own colours. His brothers literally could jump in and out of bed and watch videos with him. His sister lay in bed and didn't leave, day or night. And so we had 5 weeks at home with him, and it was just extraordinary.
Wow.
Wow.
It's kind of say that I think on that point of that, I was thinking about Gus, and he used to giggle a lot, like a lot. And whether it was from sounds we made or shows he watched or whatever, he couldn't talk, but he could laugh. And and that was the thing, I think, for me, when he, even in the hospital when he was here, so the day, 2 days before he passed, he was laughing and still. And that's why I think I was in denial that I couldn't see how someone could be still laughing and then be so close to passing. And but yeah, I think it's amazing how children can, you know, not in all every situation, but in sometimes they can be. You know, he had no idea, I think, what was going on, obviously, but it's just that sense of purity and humour still comes through. It's amazing.
Thinking across the whole time. Because we're talking about dads and coping and dads and doing and dads and being. What is some advice you'd give to other dads with the benefit of all that hindsight you've got in tragedy?
I think I've touched on a few things, but it's sort of recapping and saying, you know, you can't fix it. You have to understand that that's not your job anymore, that you just have to be there and be present. And on that, need to be there as much as you can, given your circumstances. If you can free yourself up, obviously, not everyone's in the situation where they can be. Everyone's got pressure on them, whether even if they own their own business or they're working for someone else. There's limitations. It's never enough. It's never enough to be there. Like, I remember lying with Gus, just thinking, how can this be what it's being? And you know, that those moments, you want them to stick, but they don't. You know, you just want them to be there forever. Those special moments when you're lying in bed with them or whatever it might be. I would say, I think I would take more videos than I did, which is a funny thing. I took a lot of photos. I probably took less videos, and I think they're amazing when you see them back. It's a weird thing, but I think it's something that I wish I'd done a little bit more of. I don't know. I think it's hard. I think everyone's going through this journey in their own way, and it's going to. But I suppose that whole, you know, the relationship preservation is super important for me. Like, different to yours, Simon, a completely different situation. But for me, we have a healthy marriage still now, and I know that for some people that gets pushed to the absolute limit. You know, trying to preserve that is so important for the health of for the child, and also for your fam, for Lottie and for Gus and for ourselves, to know that they've got each other's back. You know, to dive in when you need to help, but be there when you know. I mean, you know, sometimes I would need time out to do my own thing for me, and that was really hard for Juliet to understand. She didn't have that, or didn't necessarily want it, and selfishly I might have gone to the football or done something like that. It was just a bit of a circuit breaker, because I was dealing with work and the pressure of that, and dealing with home and feeling how I could help with that. I think sometimes you have to do things for yourself, but when your partner wants something, they need to make it clear. Because I think sometimes, as for me, and I don't know whether this is a male thing, but we don't read things very well. They need to be specific. If you need me to be home, I need to be home, and you need to tell me that. If it's not a good time to go to the football, not that I went all every week, but it's now. Don't go today. I need you here. I'm not feeling right. I need you around me. So I think that communication part is, you know, and also to admit that you don't feel what they feel is important. Sometimes it can be different. I think for me, my grief was always buried deeper, whereas Juliet's was surface level a lot more of the time. I think the communication thing is obviously a cliche, but super important about letting your guard down and admitting you don't have the answers and listening.
I don't think it's a cliche. It's very, very real.
Yeah. What's your advice then?
I think, it's also something Guy alluded to earlier about, say, grieving patterns, for example. So I think communication's critical. And when I look back, Milsom and I, we had different needs, different styles, actually. So you may have guessed I kind of like to talk.
That's important.
And research and pull information down and talk about the experience. At times, I think for Milsom was almost the reverse. She wanted the information, and we'd talk enormously privately. But in terms of friends and colleagues, she didn't want to do that, because it was, I guess, also maybe if the conversation was drifting to Marmaduke, it was getting very close, and she didn't want to talk about hers, didn't want to talk about her journey, and for lots of reasons, and maybe she wouldn't have the strength to talk about Marmaduke if they were sort of literally pulling those heartstrings for her. But even grief, we knew that we had different patterns, and it came again with Marmaduke, because we'd lost our first child. Our first daughter, Ella, was a very late stillbirth, about 32 weeks. So it was kind of, that was traumatic. And we learned then that our grieving, I needed to talk, and she needed to almost nurse the wounds. And that was challenging if I'm talking to family. And so we'd end up negotiating. I said, okay, look, I'm going to talk to these people. I'm going to say this. I won't mention that. And I found that was the best way of, it sounds smooth with hindsight. It was challenging at the time, but it was a way of allowing both of us to cope. And then I found the same issues, they weren't issues, they were characteristics, really. Our patterns emerged again with Marmaduke, and I needed to talk to everyone. I needed to explain it, whereas for Milsim, that was almost exhausting, and it was almost sharing intimacy with other people, whereas for me, it was actually important to release that. And so, again, we'd negotiate it. So I think if you're in a relationship, you have to understand that you're... you may not be processing things in the same way. You may not be grieving things in the same way. And that's absolutely okay if you can recognize it. And communication is the absolute key.
I think also sometimes different personalities want to go and do things. Like I was a bit of a doer about Gus's legacy, doing fundraisers and stuff like that, whereas Juliet was a lot more private. And it's similar to what you're saying, Simon. It's like, I wanted to tell the world about Gus and shout it from the rooftop that he might be gone, but he's still here and he's someone that we're going to talk about. And although Juliet is happy to talk about Gus to anyone about, it's not a taboo subject at all, but my public way of doing it was not where she sat. It wasn't her journey, and that she found that quite hard, and it was very raw for her. So I think, it's definitely different styles and, not always the same though, maybe, I don't know. It's whether it's a male thing or it's just a personality or a characteristic trait.
And I will come back to Guy's point about the photos or videos, because we were on a journey over such a long period of time, but then we had the decline, I barely have. In fact, I don't have a decent photo or video of the whole family together, because the very rare occasions where we got everyone assembled, bang, that's you were focusing on, hey, we're all together.
Yeah.
You weren't necessarily thinking, oh, let's do an image. Mm. And often you'd assemble everybody and then literally half an hour later, gone, because you're racing off somewhere. So... photos. There's lots of individual ones and groups, but not the whole family. It sounds like a small point, but God, I wish we'd had one. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add? Anything you think you planned to say but didn't?
I think the aftermath of, after Gus passed, there's a massive stop in and a shift in your life. For all these, like the amount of time, Simon, you would go to the hospital, spend the time that you'd spend with physios or, there's a lot of doctors that you had relationships with, a palliative team, and all of a sudden that stops when Gus passed, and there's a massive void in your life to a certain extent because you're not dealing with your friends as much as you were. You were fully focused on the care of this person, or this child, and I think that my advice is that we connected with very special kids because that is something that continues on. They offer counselling and activities for sibling support and stuff like that. And it was important for us in the early years to have that because they were there before Gus passed. We got respite there, which was also super important for as we go back to talk about relationships and we'd take Gus there for a night or two, and even though they weren't far from where we lived, it was a circuit breaker to be able to go out for dinner with Lottie and have time as a family and go and do some stuff, which is important. We didn't have a heap of time, but even then it was just a quick reset. For other people with their journeys a lot longer, I'm sure that would be as important. I think there can be a bit of a void. I think Very Special Kids provided a bit of ongoing through that, but I think it's something just to be aware of, maybe that can feel a little bit of a an empty space afterwards. Does that make sense, Simon? You know, you're reliant so heavily on these organisations, and they're fantastic, and all of a sudden it just goes quiet. Your situation was different to mine for lots of reasons, but even just for Juliet and I, you know, it was hard. And I think, you know, to have family and friends around and to keep checking in, it is a bit of a cliche again, that, you know, people do stop thinking about you after a while. And not in a nasty way, it's just not on their radar. Family visit less often. You know, it's just different. And I think if you know, for me, having my partner there, Juliet, they're each other. I can't imagine what you went through, Simon. But I think that where you can connect with those organisations like Very Special Kids, where they give you that ongoing support, is quite helpful.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of support for families out there. But I look back, we barely went near it during the journey, mainly because we were just
doing
flat
it.
Chat. Yeah. And so, you know, it wasn't just we didn't have the time. We barely had the time to even sort of look at what options were available. However, towards the end, we did get some really good help. So Very Special Kids came in. We had a family support person. We organised a volunteer. And so, and then charities like Challenge. We actually got help after the event. So it was actually more with bereaved siblings that I got great help. And that there probably was more help. Clearly there was more help available earlier on, but we just weren't in a position to do it. But if I see families now who are sort of entering that journey, my advice, I mean, classically, you normally encourage people to do things that you didn't do yourself. And so it would be to find a gatekeeper, somebody, it might be a friend or family who can manage those community questions or school questions and sort of take some of the pressure off, or who can maybe go online and find out what charities are there to support the siblings or the parents. And find, I guess, the finding help. That help is always out there. It's often out there in the community. It might be the school community. It's just that often, if you don't look for it or ask for it, people don't quite know what to do. And I take Guy's point as well. I think you will find it is very challenging. It's less as a dad, I think, just as carers and families. When you have a challenging paediatric journey, not everyone can understand. It often pushes invisible buttons for people. You'll never know what buttons it pushes, but they don't cope. And so you do some friends drift, and you can chase that rabbit hole. You can just accept, okay, it's a bit hard.
Guy, with hindsight and what's happened to you and looking forward, how are you dealing now as a dad with your family, with your kids, and the role? Has it changed? What are the things you're doing these days that you reflect on?
I think that, you know, obviously Gus is with us every day, in spirit, but also literally in the house. There's a shrine in the house, and there's lots of stuff around, and our lives very much around that. I think possibly sometimes there's so much focus on Gus still in our life that maybe even a little bit, Lottie might feel like it's still a little bit the Gus show. And I think in reflection, I probably, as much as she's here and she's getting the physical love and everything else, it's sort of, there is still so much that we talk about him every day and see around the house with his stuff and photos and or things like that. I think, you know, it's hard. It's been 7 years now, and I think that in a way it feels it's almost harder in some ways, because I feel he's getting further away from when I last had him here. And although you learn to live with it, probably is the way I like to look at it. But I, you know, I think as a partner and as a dad, I think, you know, there's still, it's hard to explain, but there's still a lot of gusts in our life, and there always will be. And it must seem weird to some people because it's been so long ago for them. But for me, I feel like it's not that long ago. It's every now and again you get these little moments of a smell or a something that will just trigger that. And coming back here is something that is always challenging. You know, there's been lots of really good memories at the hospital that we felt like we were being really cared for, but then it's that moment of, you know, thinking about the last time we came here and the last time we left. It's hard in that sense, but I think overall I've always had good feelings about the place, and I know that sometimes for some other families that I've met, they haven't always had that experience, not because of, you know, just because of the way things ended up or... you know, ours was one of Gus got cared for and nurtured, and you know, ultimately it was sad to say goodbye to the community here in a way. Like I said before, there's a bit of a void from that. Does that kind of answer the question? I know I went around about way there by saying it, but I think as a dad and looking back on Gus now, I'd carry him every day, and I think most parents would do that.
Simon?
Look, I think Marmaduke, I mean, he. I just think of him and I smile. Had such an amazing, it was such a privilege to have spent time with someone so, I don't know, glorious, just an amazing, mischievous personality. I do hear people often say, I hear what Guy says about, oh, people feel that they're, as the years go by, that person is drifting, they're losing touch. Whereas for some reason, I've never actually felt that. I've always, because he's present for me now. And I just need to think of, I've got an image of Marmaduke and bang, he's in my head. And I draw a lot from that. And so he's within our family. We talk about Marmaduke, we talk about Milsom. It is always a balance. Like, absolutely, I never wanted to be, it's too hard, subject we can't talk about. So we had images, we'd celebrate birthdays, we'd do cakes. It'll be, what should we bake for Marmaduke's birthday? What sort of flavours? And sometimes the boys go, well, I want chocolate, I want mint, so we do a mint chocolate. You know, we'll sort of work it through. As they get older, we may celebrate, we might mark sort of anniversaries of, say, funerals and things, which obviously my daughter and I do that, but obviously for the younger boys, it's not been something we've actually wanted to focus on. But then you also, and of course, you do think, is it too much? Is the focus too much? So you've, I don't think there's an answer to that. It's how you live your life. So, I guess I've gone from, if I talk about Marmaduke with my family, often it'll be in stories, and I'll be looking for stories where, his brothers and sister were involved. Do you remember what you did this? And I'm sort of reliving or creating new memories by explaining it that way.
For me, the year that I had with Gus was like, it feels like sometimes I look back and think it didn't happen. Like, Gus didn't happen, and I don't mean that in a nasty way, but because did that really, did we really go through that? That really happened to us? Like, you know, and you know, of course we know he had him and all that, but it's just, it feels like that year was a blur, even though it was the longest year of my life in one way. In other ways, it's like, you know, it just feels like, I don't know, it's like even coming back here, it's like, oh yeah, I used to come here a lot, you know, it's like... And life is not like that now. It's different, you know. And I certainly, like you say, I think about Gus like all the time, and he's with me. And but then there's moments where I have this gasp of like, And I feel like it's like this attack, like a fear attack of just, oh, let's Gus, you know? And it's like, it's like a, for me, because I bury the grief quite deep, it cuts, it's like there's this opens it up, and it's only for a moment, and it sort of closes up again, but it's like so raw, like a, it's hard to explain, but yeah, it's just, it's sort of trying to remember how you felt in that year, and that it's hard, you know, it's sort of, it was a crazy time, I suppose, is what, you know, like what you went through in your journey is like, there was so much organization going on at that time. Like I was working and helping, and, you know, there's lots of time downtime where you're at home, you have to be at home and all that, but you're sitting there thinking about what you have to do. You're still planning what you're going to cook for dinner, or you've still got to live your life. It doesn't stop. It's not like everyone's taking care of everything else. All you got to do is look after your child. It doesn't happen that way. It doesn't matter. It's just, so does that make sense? It's sort of like a, you know, it's a hard one to, you know, and that's, I suppose, that, not that you can put this on there, but it's for families going, or dads going through it, it's incredibly hard, obviously, for lots of reasons, and it's going to be the worst time of their life, you know, by a long way. And the only way they can get through it is by preservation and being optimistic about, because for a lot of people there isn't, you know, I've spoken to families that have single parents that have lost their only child and that's it, you know, through an accident or whatever it is. And it's like, it's a different topic, but it's, you know, there's always, you know, your experience was horrifically worse than mine, even though mine was bad. You know, I look at it
it's
go,
not a competition.
No, but you know, yeah. I look at that. I know families that have children with Battens, they've lost two, because by the time they had their second, they didn't know they had the genetic disorder, and it's one in four, and bang, they've lost two children or both their children. And I look at that and go, you know, and people say to you, oh, at least you've got Lottie. Like, it's such a horrible thing to say. But in a way, it's true. I do have Lottie and I do have Juliet. You know, and for me to have that and have them and have known that we've gone through that together is comforting, and it's special and it's amazing. And it's like, I wouldn't want to do it again, but it's, you know, does that make sense? So I don't know how you can sit here and give people advice and stuff, but to sugarcoat it, it's horrific. It's, you know, and it's work, and it's all those things that need to be done to make the journey better for the child and yourself. Is like, does that make sense, Simon?
Yeah, it does. I mean, look, listening to that, I think the one thing that is so important is that sense of perspective. And obviously we're sitting here and we've lost a child. And I remember vaguely, it is vague, there was a time when the worst possible outcome might have been that my son couldn't be saved. There was a time when I was in hospital ward thinking, oh my God, what if this treatment doesn't work? And I remember how gut-wrenching that feeling was. But when I say I can barely remember it, because obviously then we suddenly shifted and we were juggling two terminal journeys, and you're not at peace with it, but you just accept it.
Yeah.
But the perspective, you realize what's important in life. And it's, unfortunately, you know, this is what society, you don't need a child dying to reinforce that. That's what happens. And that's probably, how do we live our life now? In the same way that, you know, try and be present for the kids now. Try and value what's important. And whoever's listening to this now, you go home, you've got family, you've got loved ones. Yeah, just get your perspectives right. Just understand what's truly important.
Good point.
Good point.
And you say it all the time to people, like, you know, hug your child, and people, you know, the way that sometimes they lead their lives, the way they let their children do things, I look at it and I don't think they realise how precious they are. That's just me being ultra, not that I'm that protective of Lottie, but I'm fairly protective, but I just look at it and just go, oh, God, you know, they're such a fragile thing, really, in our care, but...
And there's one thing you asked about the hospital. So coming back to the hospital, we had such a good, well, obviously we had a very staggered history, but actually the support and the quality of care was extraordinary all the way through the journey, and in particular the palliative care. And so I see familiar faces when I walk back in the hospital, and I know people who, and I go, yes, yeah, I remember you jumping out of your skin because Marmaduke played a joke on you. I remember, you know, so all of those things, they're really happy memories. Mm. And so it feels quite a warm sensation coming back.
Okay, I want to say thank you to both of you for sharing such an amazing, sad, long, short journey with us today on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Royal Children's Hospital podcast series, Life, Love and Loss, Caring for a Child Who is Dying. The Royal Children's Hospital Victorian Paediatric Palliative Care Program and all its health professionals would like to thank those parents who've generously taken part in this series. You can search all the episodes online at rch.org.au/podcasts. I'm Lena Kenever. Thanks for listening.